I am here today with Marcus Walton. This is Bull City's podcast, Sex and the Bull City.
Got it.
I
Nailed
got it
it.
this time.
Nailed
All right. I am Celine Malone, the newest associate at Bull City Psychotherapy. I've been here for about a year. I did my internship here, taking new clients, just to be aware. And this is Marcus. We met earlier this week and recorded about purity culture, and we're here to talk a little bit more of it.
Yeah, and
Go ahead and remind us about a little bit about you.
I'm an intern here at Bull City, and taking clients, open to clients. It's pro bono or sliding scale, $10 to $30. Very cheap, very good. Yeah, come on
And you're going to be with us through
in.
August,
Yeah, that's right.
July,
I'm gonna be
August.
here as an intern through August, and then I'll graduate and be licensed and see where I go from there. I might stay here.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So we introduced the concept last time of purity culture, how it relates to evangelical Christianity, the kind of the background and the roots that you and I share. And so when we were thinking about the follow-up that we wanted to do to that, gender roles came up for us as just a thing that we could explore a little bit more. Everything from the male gaze is a topic we want to address, and the impacts on both genders, and other effects that having these strict expectations around the performance of what's in your pants
Well said.
comes out.
Well said. Yeah, there's a lot of harm that can come from a rigidity of those roles, you know.
But that's the expectation frequently. And so that's why we're talking about it today. You may have experienced this if you share a similar background to what we have. Or this might be brand new to you and just an interesting topic. So one of the things that we were just talking about, and I wanted to kind of explore more with you, the male gaze. Tell me what that means to you, and I'll tell you what it means to me.
Yeah, I think to me it is the objectification of women, you know, that is sort of the male gaze, right? The image there is the act of looking, and the act of looking and staring, and in a way that I think frames the relationship as when we say objectification, like subject object. So there's I am the male, I am the one with subjectivity, agency, power in the situation, right? And you are the female, sort of receives, right? Yeah, this in a concrete way, and then we'll get to what, you know, your definition or idea there. But I was just telling her about remembering that I was involved in a Bible study at one point when I was in youth group, and we were following a book called Every Young Man's Battle, which is very exciting because you could regard not masturbating as like being Russell Crowe in The Gladiator or something. You know, it was like
An apt metaphor.
a
I'm not
fight to
sure
the
about
death.
that.
But I remember something from that, which you know, wasn't all bad, I think, practically speaking. And I think it's an interesting case of I don't know, not a bad practice that comes from, I think, a really weird sort of, you know, theory and framework of sexuality. But there was something in the book about bouncing the eyes, and which is really kind of, you know, taking seriously the male gaze in a certain way, and saying like, it's your responsibility as a man to control your sexuality and not impinge upon the freedom and comfort level of women around you, right? And so don't not to objectify them with your gaze. And when you catch yourself staring, you know, bounce your eyes. So anyways, that's a touch point there. So what so comes up for you? Yeah.
As you're talking about that, mm-hmm. I'm feeling both supportive and critical of that.
Yeah.
In that supportive in that staring at women is probably a bad idea. But there's also the sense in which the male gaze from a female perspective is a wider concept, that it's not just looking at women or even just looking at them as objects. The not looking is also a form of objectification in that you're still the one in the observer role. You're choosing to look, choosing not to look. And I'm not sure that this translates to practical advice in terms of, keep staring. Not what I'm saying.
Right.
I think that aspect of that, you know, bouncing the eyes, if you catch yourself staring, you know, I think that's probably wise. And going deeper than that is where I want to take this conversation, because the deeper part of that is consider your role as the observer. That you're not just trying to not look. You are actively viewing that as a person. There is care and empathy and humanizing and not just seeing a body. In any sphere, right? You know, this brings up an interesting point for me. Is there a place for objectification in our sexual lives? Can we appreciate the form of someone that we find attractive?
Right.
You know, and and in what ways can that be healthy? In what ways can that be harmful?
Right.
And I think the word just is going to come into play, because I think if you see somebody as just a body, you are dehumanizing, you're taking away their agency. Right. If you see somebody as a whole human, and then at the same time, you are appreciating their form, that's part of who they are. And that might sound like semantics, but being on the other end of it feels very different.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm thinking here something that we were talking earlier about, which I think can kind of come in here and map onto this well and give it a little structure, is that so the one a piece of background for religious fundamentalism, you know, is that it's one of the things that really defines it and gives it its sense of structure, a rather rigid structure, is sort of clearly codified morality, which is sort of rules of do's and don'ts. And so we get this practical piece of advice, right, about bouncing your eyes, and it becomes another rule to sort of structure behavior. And it's like the other thing that I feel like you're proposing here feels more like, you know, what we would call ethics, which is that the work of figuring out what is right and wrong in a situation is dynamic and contextual, right?
Context of a relationship. Objectification, viewing someone as a sexual, physical being might be appropriate.
Right.
In that context.
And, you know, in a way, purity culture does that. It says when outside of the context of a married relationship, right, no kind of sexual objectification is permissible. And so I do think
I agree with that.
Right. There's the you're sort of kicking the can down the road further and further of like marriage, you know, like marriage will be the thing that is the great moment of permission, wherein, you know, as you, we were kind of talking last episode about just like all your wildest sexual dreams will come true once you're married. And so it, yeah, but even there, it lacks, there's kind of like morals that run all the way up to marriage. Mm-hmm. And then it's interesting. There's almost a like implied free for all. In a certain way.
As long as it remains within the bounds of that marriage.
Right. Mm-hmm. And instead of how sex actually works, which is a constant kind of checking in with a certain kind of ethical reasoning, you know?
And say more about that.
Well, for instance, like consent. Is like always a thing to be considered. Whereas I think probably within a fundamentalist evangelical kind of purity culture understanding, it's, you know, like once you're married, it's all the sex that you want, kind of, right? And, but there's a kind of, sex is sort of implicitly owed then in a lot of times, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, it's something that, both partners owe to one another as a duty of marriage. And so I guess there is that moral structure, like, continues, right? Mm-hmm. You owe your partner sex as a part of being married. That's part of the contract, you know? And so a contractual structure is a little more like a moral structure as opposed to ethics, which are, again, I feel like there's that sense of every day and every moment is new, you know? And, like, you learn what your partner likes. You learn what your partner's into. You learn yourself. And yet, I think there's something beautiful about, like, some sense of also starting with a blank slate with that ethical reasoning. I'm just like, I don't know. What are you into today? You know? What are you comfortable with in this moment? Yeah.
You know, I think of a conversation we had recently about consent. And how it's not just a checkbox at the beginning of a process to make sure you don't get in any legal trouble.
Right. Right.
Like, it's not, legality of sex should not be the ceiling. That's really the floor.
Yeah. yes.
That, sure. You know, in therapy, we have this concept of informed consent. And that means that as the relationship continues, from the time a client first walks in the door to the very last session that they ever have with you, you're in this ongoing process of explaining what to expect, what your limits are, what the boundaries are, and letting people make decisions for themselves based on those parameters.
Yeah.
And bringing the concept of informed consent into sexuality, I think takes it to that deeper ethical level that you're describing, that it's it's about the overall where you are with someone or someones in relationship. And it's not just they said yes, and so we're good.
Right.
Or they married me, and so now everything I want belongs to me.
Right.
And, you know, to come back to our conversation around gender roles, you know, I mentioned in our last podcast that one of the frequent outcomes, whether it's intended or not, one of the frequent outcomes of purity culture is this sense of gatekeeping by women. That women are set up to be the ones who say no.
Right.
And they are expected to be less sexual, not want sex. Be more pure.
That's right.
That's why we call it purity culture, right?
Right.
At least that was my experience of purity culture. That men could be forgiven their sexual indiscretions.
Right.
But women, the illustration was they're like a rose,
yeah,
or a flower.
Mm-hmm.
And when they have sex, the petals fall right off.
Mm-hmm.
And then do you really want to give that to someone that you love? You know, those petals have fallen off and we stomp on them on the floor.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, it's rough.
Somehow this it's has rough. Changed something fundamental about them and made them less.
Yeah.
And if you have made yourself less for your partner, you've done a disservice to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my experience of purity culture.
Mm-hmm.
That women are put into that role.
Mm-hmm.
And men are put into the role of pursuers,
mm-hmm.
the ones who are pushing for sex, the ones who are hoping right. and expecting and pressuring.
Mm-hmm.
And go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, or, you know, again, when I think the men do look like courteous and respectful,
mm-hmm.
they're put in, and maybe this goes back to what you're saying about they're still the subject, you know, they're still mm-hmm. the one who's sort of in control.
Observing.
Yeah. Like, or they're not, and this can be kind of fluid, them going back and forth between these roles, like either the pursuer, right.
Mm-hmm.
Or, they can be kind of the protector of the fragile sort of feminine, like you said, like mm-hmm. this flower, you know,
mm-hmm.
and again, that sounds better on one level as opposed to kind of predator and prey,
right?
You know, which is the pursuer is mm-hmm. that kind of model, but I don't know. Somehow it's playing out the same dynamics in a different register.
Was that your experience? I know you said for you were all in on purity culture and remaining pure. And
mm-hmm.
Was that your experience that you felt this need or this pressure to
yes.
protect
yes.
the purity of
oh, yes.
yourself and your partner?
Yes. I was okay. I was a very good boy. And I did what I was supposed to do. And so, yeah, I had a serious high school girlfriend for mm-hmm. years, and we were very, very protective of our purity, you know? And, yeah, it's a thing I look back on and I don't know, it's still somewhat mysterious to me, you know? I had a lot of desire. I was a mm-hmm. teenage boy, you know? Yeah.
So, you know, I like where you took that in terms of this being that same kind of objectification, that mm-hmm. the woman's purity is the object.
Yeah.
And it must be protected, regardless of which role you're choosing in that,
mm-hmm.
whether you're choosing to protect it, you're choosing to pursue it.
Right.
She remains the object,
mm-hmm.
the thing that is being pursued, the mm-hmm. thing that is being protected. And she's a thing.
That's right. And also it's like playing it out along the timeline, along this certain narrative arc, right? That's headed towards marriage.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, is like, what is it that makes, I'm just spitballing here. I'm curious about this. What is it that makes the marriage bed undefiled, so to speak, right?
Mm-hmm.
If having sex is to somehow break this mm-hmm. fragile thing, this fragile object,
mm-hmm.
or to make impure what was pure, it definitely trades on a certain kind of magical thinking
mm-hmm.
that I think our actual feelings and reasoning doesn't really square with, which is to say, if sex is dirty before, what is the magic that makes it not dirty after?
Right.
And that is a long shadow and a cost of purity culture is that
mm-hmm.
people get to be adults and they're like, they can even get married and they can be like, why do I still feel dirty and bad about mm-hmm. having sex now that we did the magic thing? We got married.
Right.
It should just be, I should just feel great now, but I still right. feel weird and guilty.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's a thing.
Absolutely.
It's totally a thing.
Totally something that happens. You know, I've had clients talk to me about, you know, this ongoing view of themselves as being less than mm-hmm. now that they are sexually active.
Yeah.
While at the same time, mm-hmm. At least among female clients, feeling this pressure that they ought to be more sexual. They ought to be more wild and carefree and experimental and knowing where to take that, you know, how to go from no sexuality to this wild abandon.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
It's just not how it works.
Well, so talk to me about that as like a, I don't know, almost a, and this isn't a withering criticism by any means. I think we've kind of gone back and forth on like the virtues of a lot of the basic assumptions of a sex positive framework. Mm-hmm. And I kind of joked that, you know, mm-hmm. like, I think I'm sex neutral. It can be good and bad. And, you know, but like, I'm, correct me if I'm mm-hmm. wrong, but I'm hearing there that there is some kind of cultural pressure to, you said, like, be wild and kind mm-hmm. of like, go out there, like, treat yourself, girl, you know, right. like that kind of thing. That seems like, I generally speaking, a product of sex positive culture. And mm-hmm. so, like, you know, I think you rightly are like, I'm a defender of sex positivity. I think mm-hmm. it's a really good force in the world. So, you know, what's happening there? Why is it, how is it acting as this force that's kind of, I don't know, not somehow not supporting or honoring someone's journey, you know, there?
You know, I think it's going to come back to objectification.
Hmm. Okay.
I am pro hmm. any sex that's not objectifying. Any sex that allows people to treat each other as human and respect the mm-hmm. the complexities of that mm-hmm. before, during, and after can be a good thing.
Yeah.
And partly it's a backlash to my upbringing.
It's good to have awareness of
right
that, you know?
I'm very aware yeah. that this is a backlash, and I would also say I'm kind of a sex geek in that
yeah
I love the academics of it. I am getting my PhD in clinical sexology. I like to think about it, and that's because, to me, mm-hmm. this is one of the most human endeavors.
Mm-hmm.
It mm-hmm. involves our politics. They come in the bedroom all the time.
Oh, yeah.
It involves our religion. That's what we've been talking about. It involves our education. Mm-hmm. It involves our relationships at the deepest level.
Mm-hmm.
It's our fears about being vulnerable and, you know, bringing those things into a safe space. Mm-hmm. I'm just fascinated by that. And mm-hmm. I have to view sex as powerful, but yet positive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think we've had interesting conversations around that of like, how do we relate to things that are really powerful in a mm-hmm. way that doesn't get reactive and fearful. And I think that's a lot of what characterizes purity culture is mm-hmm. being really afraid of the power of sex.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, I think somehow also really and knowingly, irresponsibly wielding power over over sex.
Yeah.
So it's, I kind of want to, I feel like I've given a lot of evidence, so to speak, you know, of the, like, you know, there are some good intentions in purity culture, but I think there's also, there are these deep roots in purity culture that are related to patriarchy, you
know,
control, mm-hmm. control of women's bodies, mm-hmm. and you talk about
ownership.
Yeah, I was going to say, you talk about objectification. It's, I was thinking about how, like, so much of the structure of moral thinking is contractual, mm-hmm. and contracts are about property, mm-hmm. you know? And for a very, very long time, marriage was primarily about property, mm-hmm. you know?
And that's, you know, the one of the ideas that I came away from purity culture with, that this, my sexuality didn't belong to me. It belonged to my mm-hmm. future husband. Mm-hmm. And that
yeah.
if I were to give it away, mm-hmm. I'm giving away his property.
Yeah. And that's, and
that's problematic.
Totally.
And while I'm sure some people have had the positive intentions that you are describing, there are people that really just like to be in charge. Mm-hmm. That makes them feel safe in this world. That yeah. makes them feel important. Mm-hmm. And they think that their way is the way.
Yeah. And I think there are complex systems of self-deception that are sometimes at play where
100%.
Where people, again, it's like we don't have that many odious villains in the world who are like rubbing their hands together as they're hatching evil plots before they go to bed at night, you know. People think that they are following and helping to support a moral order mm-hmm. that is for the good of all when they're
for sure.
when they're investing in systems that are really destructive and oppressive, you know.
What I have noticed about human nature is that there is a tendency to notice when your power is draining. Mm-hmm. Or when people are proposing things that might make you slightly less in charge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I've experienced this within a religious context that any kind of dissent, mm-hmm. any kind of disagreement is met with this panic. Mm-hmm. And I think that comes from feeling threatened. Now, I would say very few people can identify mm-hmm. that that's what's happening. They, like you said, they're not rubbing their hands together at night and thinking, oh, here's mm-hmm. how I'm going to control Celind. Mm-hmm. I doubt anybody thinks that closely about me, period.
Right.
But when there is a situation that they feel they need to be in charge and they have been duly placed there by God, mm-hmm. especially.
Yeah.
There's a certain authority that they feel that they bring to that situation that they have a right to insert themselves into the sex lives of others, mm-hmm. which
yeah.
in any other situation, if it were not a religious moral failing to be sexually active before marriage, mm-hmm. would be really creepy. If somebody was really, really interested in your sex life or the sex life of your teenagers, mm-hmm. and really inserted themselves in their sexual decisions and, mm-hmm. you know, in any context, yeah. that would be problematic, I hope. And yet, in purity culture, mm-hmm. it's routine.
Yeah.
And justified.
Yeah.
And that's about control.
Mm-hmm.
It's mm-hmm. justified because God told me.
Yep.
So for me,
yeah.
sex positivity is a way of reclaiming a very human endeavor. Mm-hmm. I qualify it in that sex that objectifies mm-hmm. is likely not ethical. And I'm not talking about the kink there.
Because
I want to acknowledge this is a kink that can be engaged in safely. Right. And we can talk a little about that in probably another episode because we're running low on time today.
Yeah.
But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about treating another person with care and respect and autonomy. And within that context, that's a qualified sex positivity. But within that context, I am all in. There are so many benefits to, at the very least, being able to make your own decisions around sex and not doing it because of coercion either direction.
Yep.
Not being coerced into having it and not being coerced into not having it.
Yep.
Being able to make decisions that are right for you based on education. This is why public education, and I'm going to take a stand here, public education needs to be talking about these things. Definitely. All education needs to be talking about these things because it's part of our humanity. And this is why I think we are kind of in the place that we're at with people wrestling with their value as sexual selves.
I think there's, I imagine there's a lot of resistance among, let's say, fundamentalist, religiously minded people with sex positivity because they're not wanting to cede that ground to authorities they don't trust. And, you know, I think it was interesting. I don't know. I was thinking, well, if sex positive, or if purity culture is kind of implicitly in the way that we framed it, sort of a moral order, a fairly rigid moral order about sexuality that says sex is bad unless, and then there's kind of a list. It's, I'm sure that some people experience sex positivity as a kind of alternative moral order that's like sex is good unless. And, but I think so much of what we've talked about here is, as we kind of said, sexual ethics, which is like, maybe it's not bad to have like some certain ground rules or ideas. Like we, like consent is kind of like, in some ways it's like, we want to have these rules. And then it gets on the legal arena, which is like all about really clearly codified rules, you know, which is how we choose to organize our public life, you know, is through enforcing and interpreting those. But on the ground, trying to be good people and trying to take care of communities, it really does feel like we need some kind of a broad and inclusive sexual ethics. And the trouble is, how do you make that inclusive for as many people as possible?
Humanize. Treat the other person as a person first. And their sexuality can be an aspect of that. You know, this is probably not super sex positive in that I'm not really advocating for hookup culture. Because it's so easy to not treat another person with respect when you don't know them.
And that's where, again, it's, you know, second wave feminism, the sexual revolution, there's sort of this, again, the pendulum swing, you know, we're always recovering from whatever the last pendulum swing was, right? And like trying to think the world right. And permissivity, you know, sort of reigned. And of course, it had with it all these, like, gifts and then all these costs. And, like, we're always trying to get centered, right, from whatever the last pendulum swing was.
You know, I've read some things recently that really challenged the idea of consent being the rule. You know, as I said before, that it's the floor, not the ceiling. That it's the bare minimum. And that the book I was reading, it's called Rethinking Sex. And the ethic that she, the author, brings forward is this idea of treating other people with humanity first. And that's a thing I can really get behind.
Yeah, totally.
You know, anything that dehumanizes someone else runs the risk of harm. Can you have mutual casual sex? Is there a higher risk that somebody will be harmed in that? And, you know, that's where I think we need to be paying attention. I'm not, I am not one to judge. And connection. This sense of relationship and community can only be built on that sense of respect and humanity.
I like that. Yeah, it strikes me when you, you're talking about risks. It's like we have to be realists about some of the risks that are involved. And I think, again, that's one of the things that fundamentalist structures try to do via their rigid moral orders is essentially eliminate risk, to get rid of it entirely. And
it does not happen.
No, it does. Well, it doesn't happen. So you end up just invisibilizing risks that are real and then unacknowledged and then totally unmanageable, you know? And then, but that, you know, in our ethical decision making, you know, we are choosing to manage and mitigate risk, you know? And that.
And decide for yourself what risk you want to engage in.
Yeah, exactly. And have a realistic idea of what the costs may be, you know? Yeah, exactly.
I think being able to be critical of risk and honest about it. If you're mature enough to be having sex, you need to be mature enough to be considering what the risks are.
It's, but we're so, we're so tempted by these, you know, illusions. Like, something we were talking about the other day was, you know, this idea of safe spaces, you know, and how I had a friend one time say, just like, there's no such thing as safe spaces. There's only safer spaces. Meaning risks are something we're always having to account for. And, but they're worth it in a lot of ways. They're worth it because, you know, again, I think the fundamentalist sort of creation of an environment that is supposedly without risks, there's so much vitality that is sapped with that, you know? And I think with power and energy and freedom, it's just like there's always going to be risks there, you know? It's part of the package.
And I think talking about risky sex is probably a whole other podcast.
It probably is.
We can come back and talk about that.
We covered some good ground today.
We did.
Hopefully you didn't get too abstract. I like those, the rare airs up there, the ethers.
We came back down a couple of times.
We're touching back down.
So again, we're taking clients. If this is something that has resonated with you, if you have experience with purity culture and are concerned about its effects on you and your sex life or you as a person. Find us, bullcitypsychotherapy.com. And we both work with religious trauma. We both work with
LGBTQIA clients.
Yep.
You're going to get unconditional positive regard.
That's right.
Whatever you bring in.
That's right.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us today.